Case number 22-1096. XO Energy MALP and XO Energy LLC petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Siegel for the petitioners, Mr. Glover for the respondent, Mr. Mays for the intervener.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Peter Siegel for the petitioners. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The orders on review are arbitrary and capricious on both grounds the briefing addresses. Starting with the remedy issue, there are three reasons for vacater here. First, at JA 251 to 253, the commission committed legal error in concluding that, as a matter of law, it lacked discretion to award any remedy other than the one that would be appropriate for a 206 violation itself. What my clients are asking for isn't a remedy for a Section 206 violation, it's a remedy for a filed rate violation. And if you look at page 47 of the commission's brief, they say, well, the reason we looked at Section 206 and attempted to do the Section 206 calculation is that this is a Section 206 case with no unique or novel aspects. But the filed rate violation here is a quintessentially unique and novel aspect that broadened the commission's discretion to look beyond just the comparison of two rates and obviated the necessity to calculate what would have been charged under the pre-2017 rate. So after finding that it couldn't calculate what would have been charged under the pre-2017 rate, which is a finding that we disagree with, and I'll explain why in a moment, the commission had certainly at least the entitlement and the discretion to, and in our view, the obligation to, look beyond that and attempt to find another remedy. But it didn't look beyond that. It just said, okay, we can't do the Section 206 violation. Our hands are tied. This is a filed rate violation and we can't remedy it. And that was erroneous as a matter of law. Second, even assuming the commission could look only to the pre-2017 rate for the remedy, it acted arbitrarily and capriciously in concluding that it couldn't calculate the amounts that should have been paid under the pre-2017 rate. And there are three reasons for that. The first one is that the commission asked PJM, not the independent market monitor, whether the software had been updated. But under PJM's FERC-approved tariff, it's the responsibility of the market monitor, not of PJM, to make those calculations and maintain that software. So the fact that PJM couldn't do it is really beside the point. Or the fact that PJM claims it couldn't do it is beside the point. The question is whether the independent market monitor could have done it. And FERC didn't even ask.
Before you even get to that, don't you have an issue about the rate being the default because of the timing issue?
I'm sorry, you're being the default because of the timing issue?
Yeah, like in other words, the rate gets stated because the preliminary or interim rate, it ends up being the rate because it was not approved by FERC timely.
So we certainly, it's undisputed that there was an egregious filed rate violation here. And that filed rate violation arises because PJM, without any approval from the commission in advance, charges a rate that is not the rate. And the commission won't dispute that when they stand up, and the IMM won't dispute that when they stand up. There was a filed rate violation in this case. There was no entitlement for PJM to go ahead and charge the unapproved interim rate when it didn't have FERC's approval to go ahead and do so.
But can you explain why Towns of doesn't govern this? Like, they have discretion not to order a refund. And I'm trying to understand your argument that you're saying that they didn't understand they had discretion.
Your Honor, the first argument we made in the brief was that Towns of Concord doesn't govern here. And we will readily agree with FERC that there is discretion to fashion a remedy in the context of a filed rate violation.
Including no remedy, if they choose to do that.
So on some facts, the commission has discretion not to provide a remedy. That's what Towns of Concord stands for. Towns of Concord was the case that involved an accidental pass-on overcharge of $30,000 over 15 years. And the regulated entity essentially got a bill, passed it on to ratepayers, and didn't, according to the case, didn't really even look at the bill. They just sort of passed it on. And it turned out that at some point when they were passing those bills on, the components of the bill changed. Something was added that they weren't allowed to pass on.
I understand.
And the commission says,
but similar to Towns of Concord, you could only prevail if they are required to give refunds. And I don't see that.
No, Your Honor. We, even if you assume that there's discretion not to provide a refund in general, our argument is that the bases that the commission invoked for declining to provide a refund here are arbitrary and capricious. And the first of those bases is that is the one that I've been discussing, which is that.
So an abuse of discretion. They have discretion to decide what the refunds are, and you're saying they abuse their discretion?
They acted arbitrarily and capriciously in invoking improper grounds and irrational grounds for declining to provide a refund. And the first of those is the error of law, that they looked only at the possible Section 206 remedy calculation and didn't look at other possibilities, such as refunding all amounts paid.
Well, they looked at that because that's what you proposed, right? So, but they chose something different.
No, we did propose it, Your Honor, but what they said was the remedy has to be either the Section 206 remedy or no remedy at all. And we can't calculate the Section 206 remedy, so we can't provide anything. And
so they were at liberty to reject your calculation, but you're saying that they erred by not stating that they were doing so.
Well, they provided no reason other than an apparent belief. If you look at JA 253, they say the appropriate remedial calculation has to measure the difference between the pre-2017 rate and the unapproved interim rate. I'm paraphrasing from JA 253.
Okay, I'm looking at it. Which paragraph are you?
So that's paragraph 18. We continue to find that the appropriate refund calculation would have required a comparison of the proposed 2017 forfeiture rule with the pre-2017 FDR.
But they said that's the appropriate refund calculation. Isn't that them saying that they think it would be appropriate that it must be done this way, which is different from we have no choice but to do it this way?
They offer no reasoning other than, and if you look at page 47 of their brief, what they say is the reason for that is that this is an ordinary Section 206 case with no unique aspects. But it's undisputed this isn't an ordinary Section 206 case. This is a Section 206 case with a filed rate violation on top of it. As Judge Shouts was mentioning, under an ordinary Section 206 case, what they would have done would have been to continue charging the pre-2017 rate until a new just and reasonable rate was approved. And then the commission would have looked at the difference between the new just and reasonable rate and the pre-2017 rate, and it would have had discretion. You know, there are a lot of D.C. Circuit cases about the discretion that it has in the context of Section 206. Provide a refund, it cannot provide a refund. FERC has a lot of policies about when it does so and when it doesn't do so. But in this case, what FERC concluded was we can't do that calculation because, essentially, there was a filed rate violation. We don't know what would have been paid if PJM had followed the law and continued to charge the pre-2017 rate. That's a mystery. And the reason it's a mystery is because they violated the filed rate doctrine and didn't do what Section 206 required them to do, which was to continue to charge that rate.
So am I understanding your argument to be that they would have had discretion to say that the correct calculation is the one that finds the difference between the pre-2017 rate and the 2017 rate, et cetera? But because they did not state we're exercising our discretion to do that and did not explicitly state and we're rejecting the just refund everything approach that you proposed, that they erred. It's really a matter of the way they phrased it, is my understanding of what you're saying.
No, Your Honor, I disagree with that.
But you're saying that they would have had discretion to do that, but you're just saying they didn't exercise their discretion because of the way they phrased it in paragraph 18?
No, they didn't ultimately do that, right? They would have had discretion to provide a remedy based on that. But what they found was we can't provide a remedy based on that first calculation. That's our option A. And we can't do it because we don't know what would have been charged under the pre-2017.
But they're not saying we can't. They're saying the appropriate calculation is this comparison of proposed 2017 with pre-2017. They're saying that it's the appropriate way. And since we can't do it, we're not going to provide a refund. But you're saying that because of the way they phrased this, because they used the word required, they didn't recognize they had discretion.
Well, and they provide no reason. To the extent you want to look at the phrase, the appropriate refund calculation, I think your point is maybe they were exercising discretion because they say the appropriate refund calculation would have been this.
Yes.
The question is why? It's utterly arbitrary that they determined that that's the only appropriate refund calculation. Under Section 309 of the Federal Power Act, they have broad remedial discretion to remedy violations of this core doctrine. And
but again, they have discretion to reject your proposal. And you're just saying they didn't explicitly say, and we reject that.
No, they didn't provide any reason for determining that the appropriate refund calculation is this measure instead of a different measure. We propose other measures as well. And under APA review, they can't simply say those don't work. They have to say why those don't work.
Can I ask you a different question? Can you explain the leverage point? I'm having a little trouble understanding what that issue is and why the response was allegedly inadequate.
Sure. So this goes to the 2021 rate. And I do have other points that I'd like to return to if time permits on the remedial issue. But on the leverage issue, and on the 2021 rate, we have 2 points. We have the portfolio issue.
Understand.
And the leverage issue. And the basic idea of the leverage issue is that if you don't stand to make more money from supposed FTR manipulation, then you would lose in the process of engaging in virtual trades to manipulate the FTRs.
Why is that leverage?
So the
when I think of leverage, I'm thinking you're taking on debt to buy securities. It's bothering me.
The idea is you've got more weight on, in order to make money through your FTRs, you have to have more weight on your FTR position than on your virtual trade position. And if you have more on your virtual trade position, you're not going to sacrifice the virtual trade position to make money on the FTR position. It's the same concept as, you know, in a chess match, you might sacrifice a pawn to save your queen. You're not going to sacrifice a queen to save your pawn. And the idea is that in the context, and really, the first thing I would say is, in the orders on review, if you can't parse what the leverage position is and why they rejected it, that's a reason for vacater and reversal. The commission is required to explain the justification for its action. And if sitting here today, we can't determine the justification for its action, then that's the ground for vacater. Of course, the leverage issue, as we pointed out in the brief, it is impossible to determine why they rejected it because they repeatedly conflated it with the portfolio argument, which is a different argument from the leverage argument. And it seems that they rejected the portfolio argument irrationally on the ground that they had already rejected the leverage argument. And then when we talk about the leverage argument, they just go back to the grounds on which they rejected the portfolio.
Are you saying then that if there isn't leverage, then there isn't market manipulation? Because in order to, of course, the whole purpose of manipulation is to make a profit from it. So are you, is this sort of by definition what the manipulation would be, that the FTR, that you have more weighted FTR so that when you change your virtual portfolio, you're making a profit on the FTR? I'm trying to understand, because they say, is it necessary? And I'm trying to understand, like, is it necessary that for there to be leverage in order for there to be manipulation?
Yeah, so short answer, yes. And I actually think, if you'll indulge me, it's easier to explain through the portfolio concept, okay, which is very similar to the leverage concept. And I'll explain how they're slightly different, but they're the same general, they're related general. So the portfolio idea is that if you stand to make money on an FTR, you know, a $5 FTR, say, going in one direction, right? But you have a $100 FTR going in the other direction. Mm-hmm. And then your virtual trades, they would be promising and helpful for the $5 FTR going in the first direction. But they would lead you to lose money on the $100 FTR going in the other direction. And I should make clear this is a gross oversimplification.
Yes,
but the commission said, well, you might have an incentive still to manipulate for the benefit of that $5 FTR. So we don't even have to look at whether, in fact, you would be losing $100 on some other FTR portfolio. And we said that doesn't make any sense. Nobody would engage in that conduct as FTR manipulation. You might want to make virtual trades that would have that effect, but you'd be making them for another reason. For instance, you think you're going to make a profit on the virtual trades. You're not doing it to manipulate FTRs because you're going to lose $95 on FTR. And you know that in advance. And so what the commission and the IMM both said is, well, we don't want this to depend on whether you're going to make a profit. But our point isn't look at it from after the fact, and if you don't make a profit, then you get off scot-free. It's that nobody would engage in the conduct as FTR manipulation in the first place because they know I'm going to lose money on my FTRs if I do that. So it's not FTR manipulation. Are there further questions on the...
How does that explain leverage?
And so the leverage concept, I apologize for not returning to leverage concept, but the basic idea of this portfolio concept is that the trades are going to cause you to lose more money on your FTRs than you would overall than you would gain on the single FTR that you supposedly manipulated. So you would never manipulate the FTR. The leverage concept is you're going to lose more money on these virtual trades than you would stand to gain on the supposed FTR manipulation. So you're not going to engage in that conduct because, again, you know in advance that if you don't stand to gain more from the FTRs, then you're going to lose with respect to your virtual position. You're just not going to do it. It's not profitable. And you know in advance that it's not profitable. So you're not going to engage in supposed manipulation that's a money-losing proposition from the outset. And there's been no, as we discussed, there's no response from FERC on the virtual position.
So was your proposal that before there could be a forfeiture, they have to calculate the leverage basically to make sure that they would have profited from this?
Yes. They have to take account of leverage positions and in the portfolio argument that they have to look at the entire portfolio. They can't zero in just the FTR at issue. They have to look at whether you would have stood to make money.
That's the portfolio one. I'm talking about leverage. So what was your proposal on what they should do about the leverage issue?
So I don't know that it got more granular than take account of leverage. Look at whether a particular market participant actually stands to gain more from the FTR than they would lose in, quote, manipulating the FTR. And if they don't, then it can't be FTR manipulation. Because
I see. So the idea is that it would not... It's necessary to manipulation because they're not making money otherwise. So there would be no incentive to do this as a manipulation.
Right, exactly.
So your point would be that it is necessary, that leverage is a necessary component of manipulation in this context.
Yes, exactly.
And so when the commission said it is not necessary, that was... arbitrary.
Yeah, we disagree with that, and I would love to disagree with their reasoning for that, except as we sit here, we have no idea what it was.
What's your remedy for them not sufficiently explaining to remand for the explanation?
So on the virtual issue, I think only a remand would be appropriate. The record just doesn't demonstrate what the commission's rationale was at all. On the portfolio issue...
On the leverage issue.
On the leverage issue, I think remand is appropriate. I don't think...
Remand without vacater.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Vacate and remand. We have no basis for concluding why they reached the decision they did. I think vacater is appropriate in those circumstances in addition to remand.
Will it create confusion in the market if we vacate? If we could remand and say, explain yourself better and not vacate, but would it create confusion in the market if we were to vacate?
So I want to address that. I would first say the remand without vacater approach is usually adopted when there's some reason to think that the agency would reach the same result on a remand. And again, here, we have nothing from the agency about why they reached the result. And
we need more explanation.
Well, it's true that we need more explanation, but also there's no reason to think that if the commission were actually put to providing that explanation, they would reach the same result, because in our view, as we've discussed, it doesn't make sense. And it's the same in the context of the portfolio issue, except that there they've actually provided their rationale, and it doesn't make sense. The rationale is essentially, you might do this because you'd like to have $5 in your left pocket, even if it's going to cost you $100 out of your right pocket. And that's, they said you'll manipulate one FTR, even if you're going to lose money overall. That doesn't make any sense. There's no reason to think that if they were required to come up with an explanation that did make sense, they would reach the same result. And in our view, they couldn't possibly reach the same result. That's a vacator issue. And I think both of them are vacator and remand issues at really at worst. In the context of the portfolio approach, I think it would be appropriate to reverse entirely.
Didn't the commission explain the complexity involved in ordering refunds beyond the points you're making, and therefore didn't have to reach those points?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Everything that they said was in the context of kind of bolstering their initial conclusion that they wouldn't provide refunds under the Section 206 calculation.
No, they said, look, they balance and they addressed your issues on remand, and they didn't find, after they modified their original order in some respects, that your arguments should prevail over the balance that the agency had thought should control here.
Well, so, Your Honor, that's their bottom line conclusion, but it embeds the bevy of errors that we've discussed in the briefs. For instance, it rests on the conclusion that PJM can't calculate the refund amounts because it's failed to maintain the software to do so. But failing to maintain the software is an independent filed rate violation. The question isn't whether PJM can refund the amounts, but instead whether can perform the calculation, but instead whether the IMM, which the tariff requires to be the one that performs the calculation, can do it.
Yes, but the issue is if the necessary data for the calculation no longer exists, that's a different issue. It's not that somebody else can recreate.
So, Your Honor, I think that question goes to this reliance idea, which is that PJM said that, you know, even if we had properly maintained the software as the filed rate doctrine required us to do, you still couldn't provide a remedy here because nobody knows what market participants would have done if they had charged.
Yes, because market participants changed, the markets changed. I mean, we don't have a static situation here that a number of your arguments are premised on. And your recreation argument, it seems to me the commission could probably say, balancing what's at stake here, we exercise our discretion not to order remedies.
Well, Your Honor, those aren't magic words that they can say at the end of an irrational analysis.
Yes, but they can do that at the conclusion of an analysis that is different than yours. In other words, they don't have to accept your approach willy-nilly. They can explain why they're not going that way and come out with a conclusion that differs.
Yes, sir. I agree with that. But I would say that at every step of that analysis, they in fact made errors that made the bottom line.
Well, you're saying that a filed rate violation is different than the normal 206 violation. Why is it different? I mean, it's different in the sense in some instances, it's a more egregious violation, all right? As opposed to an error in calculation. But that doesn't make the 206 proceeding inapplicable, which seems to be the premise of your arguments here.
Well, actually, Your Honor, in one very real sense, Section 206 is inapplicable, which is that in the context of the Section 206 replacement rate proceeding, the authority to provide a remedy arises under Section 206, which very precisely sets out essentially a math problem that the commission can decide to do or not do subject to its discretion.
It's not a math problem. That's the whole point, isn't it? That Congress understood these were difficult balancing situations And it's not just adding up one column of figures versus adding up another column of figures. These are expert judgments, and Congress has delegated that expertise to these expert commissioners. Not that it's a mathematical calculation that sort of anybody could do.
Well, Your Honor, I agree with you in the context of Section 309 and remedying file grade violation. In the context of Section 206, it is a simple math problem. And the problem here is that what the commission did was it tried to do the Section 206 math problem, found it was unable to do it precisely because PJM had committed a file rate violation and made one of the variables for that math problem more difficult.
That is not what the commission said.
Your Honor, the principal basis for the commission's conclusion was the declaration of Brian Chmielewski from PJM, who said, we don't upkeep the software. We haven't maintained the software to calculate what the charges would have been under the filed rate. And even if we had, you can't know what market participants would have done if we had adhered to the filed rate doctrine and charged the filed rate. There was market participants' reliance on our violation of law. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing that, but that's the substance of what he said. We didn't follow the filed rate doctrine. We didn't charge the filed rate. And you can't know what anybody would have done if we had, but you can't provide a remedy. And the commission bought that reasoning without any recognition that that makes the filed rate doctrine, which, according to the Supreme Court's decision in Maislin, is utterly central to regulatory regimes that require just and reasonable.
And the
rate.
Commission has reaffirmed that time and time again, but it doesn't necessarily mean that a violation of the file rate doctrine obligates it to order refunds. And that's the point, it seems to me, you don't want to acknowledge in our cases, and indeed the Supreme Court have acknowledged that discretion lies with the commission.
I will readily acknowledge that discretion lies with the commission. That's Towns of Concord's.
No, you really don't. You're saying that 206 is mathematical, and that's the end of it, basically. And there's discretion, but it's very confined because this is a filed rate doctrine. And I understand your argument, and the commission could have adopted it, but it did not. And it explained in the language of our opinions, the path of the commission can be determined and reasonably understood.
So, Your Honor, I think as I've stood here today, I've actually been arguing that it was the commission that viewed its discretion as unduly constrained by Section 206. When in fact the commission's remedial discretion was broader than just the 206 remedy. And what the commission should have done was look to other possible remedies in recognition of the fact that the filed rate doctrine, it is utterly central to this regulatory regime. And so instead of just looking to the Section 206 remedy and finding, well, the filed rate violation makes it impossible for us to provide this 206 remedy, ergo, we can't do anything.
So if I may, I'm looking at what the commission did right now, paragraph 16. And I think it's important to note that the commission directed PJM to include information on, quote, the method by which PJM would calculate refunds and surcharges based on the prior rate on file. So that was the task that they assigned. They wanted the refunds to be based on the prior rate on file, which is within their discretion to determine that that's the appropriate refund. And then it says XO Energy posits that PJM should refund all FTR forfeitures dating back January 19th, 2017. So clearly they considered your proposal.
And their answer to that is,
they disagree. They want to do it based on the prior rate. They're entitled to do that. They have discretion.
So, Your Honor, if they had said only that under the APA, that would be a ground for vacator and remit. We don't want to do it. It's not a valid exercise of agency discretion.
That is not what they said, counsel. I mean, with all due respect, you may disagree with its reasoning, but what Judge Pan just quoted from the rehearing order is not what the commission said.
So, right, and that was going to be the second part of my answer. They, in fact, did not say only that. What they said was, in the context of just essentially what calculation can we do? What are we empowered to look at as a possible remedy here, right? They said, in the context of rejecting our argument that they should just refund everything.
But before your argument, they'd already decided they wanted it calculated based on the prior rate on file. That was the instruction in the prior order.
So, and then they conclude that.
And then you said that, why don't you just give us all the refund?
Right.
And they said, we disagree. And they said it should be based on the prior rate on file. And then they said that's the appropriate calculation.
Right. Because
so they're entitled to do that.
Because the pre-2017 rate was the effective rate on file.
Right.
In our view, and I recognize
I understand
way over
your
time.
View.
Our view is that's not
what they chose to do.
Right. Our view is that response was a non sequitur. That response, if this were straightforward to
I
a sixth proceeding. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Matthew Glover, and I represent the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I realize this is factually and legally complicated, so I want to start with a couple points on the remedy that I think will clarify. First of all, I think my friend on the other side made an important concession that we do have discretion even in filed rate cases. That was clear from Towns and Concord. It was clear from a few of the other cases we cited as well. The Keyspan Ravenswood, this court reversed us and said there was a filed rate violation. Go back and decide if you want to remedy that. In Consolidated Edison in 2003, we cited both of these. You did the same, you reversed us, said there was a filed rate violation. We came back in 2007 and said we've decided not to remedy that. You said we rebalanced the equity. So that's an important concession because they are tied to the arguments they made on rehearing. Their principal argument on rehearing was that we lacked discretion. But stepping into how we exercise our, I want to note one more case on the filed rate. Recently in 2018, in an unpublished decision in Ameren Services Co. versus FERC, that's number 131138 at 739 Fed Appendix 646. The court again was confronted with a filed rate violation and that we found equitably there was no remedy. And among the factors that were considered there was reliance, was the time, expense, and difficulty with developing software. It was a different regional transmission organization called MISO or Mid-Continent. They hadn't kept up their software. We said that was an issue. So I think that case looks at a lot of the same things, but there's a little bit of confusion here on the remedy. My friend keeps saying we constrain ourselves to Section 206. That's not true. Actually, the normal remedy if I can step back and look at Towns of Concord, it's more of a what I would call classic filed rate case where you were charging a cost-based rate. You weren't supposed to include the spent fuel cost, but you did. And so you were supposed to charge X, but actually you charged X plus $36,000. The remedy in a filed rate case is the remedy between what you charged and what the rate on file was. And that's why, Judge Pan, I think it was paragraph 16 at JA 251 in the hearing order you went to. We were in those paragraphs. Our heading there is the pre-2017 rate was the rate on file, right? They had made arguments both on appeal and below that there was no forfeiture rate because that rate was found unlawful. That's where the 206 provision comes in. 206 structurally, when we declare at step one a rate is unjust and unreasonable, we have to go forward with that step two process. We cited Era Energy for discussing, which I think is a 2017 case, for discussing why. There's actually two cases from the circuit that more clearly state, one of them we cited, but not for this proposition. It's the recent MISO Transmission Owners versus FERC, 45 F 4th 248. We cited it for a different proposition, but at page 253 there, the court notes that after the step one provision, quote, until FERC sets a new rate in a 206 proceeding, customers continue to pay the challenge rate. So that's why it remained the rate on file and you were supposed to continue paying. Now, if we were going to remedy this as a 206 violation, my friend did point out that 206 has some provisions. One of them is there's a 15-month limit on refunds. When you refund a 206 violation, what you do is you say you were charging an unlawful rate. You keep charging that unlawful rate, and when we figure out what the lawful rate is, you refund the difference between the lawful rate and the unlawful. So if the refund calculation for sort of a 206, if they had kept charging the pre-2017 rate and never commit the filed rate violation, we would still have discretion on whether we wanted to refund. We'd be limited in a number of months. But the refund calculation would actually be running the new rule that we approved in the compliance order. What are the refunds? What were the forfeitures under that versus the pre-2017 rule? And that's not what we were doing here. Here we were looking at the rate on file, which is the precept 2017 rule versus what you charged. That's how you remedy a file rate violation. That's what we were trying to do. We looked at factors, we asked PJM to provide us information, and we considered what we think are appropriate factors. There are factors that this court in Ameren has looked at. I would note Towns of Concord noted the difficulty and the time and expense involved in trying to reconstruct the rates at issue there. So I think each of these factors have been applied by the commission and accepted by this court in various cases on those. So I think that's the key point I would make there. I would also cite the 2014 Louisiana Public Service Commission we cited in our brief. It also went through and included, I think, every one of these factors.
Could you address the leverage issue?
Yeah, I'll take a quick break. I didn't really think about this way till I read their reply brief at 12 and then again at 14. They described both leverage and portfolio involving the intent to manipulate and needing to have the intent to manipulate. And so if you look at the compliance order at paragraph 44, which is JA204, we said there that we had previously rejected arguments about scienter or intent to manipulate in the 2017 order. No one sought rehearing of that. And so, you know, as we were narrowing the proceeding, right, it starts with the 2014 proceeding where they're adding these up to congestion trends, and we narrowed it in 2017 and said, PJM, you need to catch less hedging activity. You need to sort of narrow this rule. Here's what you need to do. In that order, we rejected scienter or intent. And so insofar as they're arguing it's a necessary component of the final rule because you can't capture intent or scienter without that, which I think is how they framed it in their reply brief. We rejected that in 2017, and in 2021, we said that that was an inappropriate collateral or an inappropriate rehearing request or collateral attack of the earlier order. And I guess this goes to some of the market monitor's points, but on the sort of inappropriate rehearing or collateral attack, again, I would cite to a very recent opinion of the court. It's another Louisiana Public Service Commission case. There's a lot of them, but this is the 2022 case number 20-1315. It's unpublished. It's from last year. It's 2022 Westlaw 801353. There, Louisiana had a series of these cases about specific remedy. We had decided, I think it was in the year 2015, that they weren't going to get certain types of refunds. They didn't seek rehearing of that. At the end of the case, they then sought to challenge those refunds. We said that's a collateral attack on our earlier order. You needed to seek rehearing. They responded, well, that earlier order wouldn't have been final, so we couldn't have gone to the Court of Appeals. And this court said FERC was within its discretion to treat its proceedings that way, and it analogized to your own law of the case precedent. That even though Louisiana was claiming it wasn't final and they couldn't have got to the D.C. Circuit in 2015, our rule was you needed to challenge that on a rehearing, and we later treated it as, sorry, Your Honor.
So can I ask, I know that you're framing this as scienter, but my understanding of their argument, and I'd appreciate your guidance on this, but beyond my depth a little bit. Their argument, I think, is that there's no manipulation unless there is leverage, because otherwise it's just a series of transactions that happens to have a certain effect. But unless they're profiting, that's not manipulation.
So that's part of the structure of this. This is an ex ante rule that is designed to catch when virtual transactions are having an impact that raises the value of your financial transmission rights, being cross-product manipulation. Again, parties argued throughout that you need to show a profit or you need to show sort of intent or other things.
I'm saying, is profit different from intent?
Well, yes, to an extent, but one of the things, and again, I don't mean to get too technical, Your Honor, but you have to understand that these are paid out and they're based on different things. So an FTR is gonna be on a path from point A to point B. And if there's congestion places along that path, you're gonna get paid for those congestion charges. One of the things we criticized PJM about and asked them to revise from the original rule was these INCs, and I think it's incremental bids and decremental, I'm forgetting the term, but the two initial types of virtual transactions where you virtually offer to buy or sell at one specific place, you're going to make money on that based on what the dollar value and sort of whether if you're selling in the day ahead and buying in the real time, if you sold for higher in the day ahead than you bought for the real time, you made money. One of the problems with the original rule, and it had this worst case scenarios thing, was you could make a bid very far away from your FTR or your financial right, and it would still like increase, and this was a problem with the 1 cent test, it would still increase the FTR in some way, and so you'd forfeit, and we said that's too tangential. And so this idea of leverage or profiting, the problem is you don't know whether you're going to make money. You're speculating on what you think the price tomorrow versus today is at this one location. And that's going to have an effect on your FTR, but you don't know, like your profit is going to be based on what happens as to that location, not what happens everywhere along the path of the FTR. And so you're sort of bidding and speculating in two different markets. And what we're concerned with is these virtual transactions can create congestion. Congestion is then paid by the transmission rate payers. And that congestion, you shouldn't be benefiting when you created that congestion with your FTR, because then you're using your virtual transactions and you are benefiting from it. Again, you might be making a really big bet on what the price is going to be like in Richmond tomorrow for power, but your FTR may run from DC to Baltimore, but that Richmond purchase, because they have to model this entire grid with where all of the power is moving, et cetera, that Richmond purchase is going to affect where they're modeling the grid and where the power is moving.
So what is the difference between... So the premise of this is if you manipulate things in your virtual portfolio that affects the price of the FTR, you would only forfeit if you're profiting on the FTR. So what's the difference between leverage and just a violation where you're profiting on the FTR?
So I think that there's two points. One is the manipulation is that your virtual transactions, which is one market, you can profit or lose in those, are benefiting your other set of transactions. And if I can give an example for where the rule is technically under-inclusive and how we don't go after intent. If you had a situation where you engage in a bunch of virtual transactions to raise the value of your FTR, you were meaning to cross-product manipulate, and you raised the value of your FTR because you created congestion between DC and Baltimore. Again, I'm simplifying, like there's only two transmission lines or something. And so congestion ended up being $100. Your FTR's value was going to be $100. You got $100 for congestion. But it's the day-ahead market for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Overnight, an act of God knocks out the main transmission line there, such that there's massive real-time congestion between DC and Baltimore. And there's a whole other case about this. PJM has a $2,000 limit, so the congestion price can't go above that, but it causes the congestion price to go to $2,000. Mm-hmm. You don't have to forfeit your FTR profits, because the last provision of the forfeiture rule is you only forfeit when the day-ahead market had greater convergence or greater congestion than the real-time market. And that's because the idea of virtual trading is that it will provide not just liquidity, but efficiency, and that the day-ahead market will look more like the real-time market because of virtual trading. And so in that case, you intended to manipulate, you did manipulate, you got money off of your FTR, but because there was market convergence, you didn't get penalized. Now, I believe it was Exelon or someone earlier on in the 2017 proceeding, there's a lot of orders and a lot of descriptions, argued that, well, wait, sometimes you can increase convergence and you're still manipulating. And it was one of the reasons we added the rule to what are called counterflow FTRs. Again, I apologize for getting really technical. But we said, we're still only going to, you know, make you forfeit your profit when at the end result was greater congestion the day ahead than in the real-time market. Again, because the virtual transactions that created that congestion in the day-ahead market, someone's paying that congestion. Like, that's actually impacting the system. And that's where, when we talk about portfolios, we're worried about your full portfolio of virtual transactions, because we're worried about how you actually caused or didn't cause congestion.
So then if your virtual portfolio, you lose money on it and you gain money on your FTR, like, why isn't that an appropriate comparison to make, which I take it is the leverage point?
Again, the point being, we don't want virtual trading, because people know that you're buying these at different times. You know that you have an FTR here. We don't want you engaging in virtual transactions. For example, you know, speculating really wildly that, gee, we really think the price in Richmond is going to go wild, but and we'll make a lot of money. But if we don't, we have this backup DC to Baltimore FTR that will also be helped by this. So, you know, in the event, if we speculate correctly, the FTR doesn't make us money, but we make a bunch of money in the virtual transactions. But if we speculate incorrectly, the FTR is going to make us money. You've still engaged in a virtual transaction that is going to raise the value of your FTR, and that's going to cause congestion, right? So we weren't looking at, gee, should you be kind of speculating wildly? It's, are you engaging in, and again, if it were only up to congestion transactions, which is the type we added, it'd be a little easier to see, because those have a start and end point. And so it's a little easier to see where those are going to have an impact. But because virtual bids can be at a location, that, you know, impacts your FTR path, but it's not the entirety of your FTR path, or it could be where the constraint is somewhere else on that path, the constraint being the congestion. It may not be the whole path. It may just be a limited piece of the path. We didn't think for an ex-ante rule, right? We wanted an ex-ante rule. Some regional transmission organizations kind of after the fact police this. But we found it acceptable for PJM in 2001 and since to have an ex-ante rule that tells you when your virtual transactions will be considered cross-product manipulation because they are impacting the value of your FTRs. You're only going to forfeit when you profit because we don't think you should forfeit when you didn't profit on the FTR. And again, that's a lot of narrowing. And if I can make one point about hedging, FTRs were designed as a hedge for load-serving entities like, I think, Exelon or Constellation in Maryland or Dominion in Virginia that serve customers, right? They have to purchase what's called firm transmission because they don't want to be curtailed when they're buying power. And so when they purchase this firm transmission, they're given these things, auction revenue, right? Anyways, they can convert these into firm transmission rights. The idea being that if you're a Virginia customer like I am, and there's congestion getting the power to Virginia, Dominion isn't going to keep changing the price on me and charging me for that. They're going to hold an FTR that will allow them to get that congestion money back. So the FTRs are designed for those entities to hedge. And that's the kind of legitimate hedging that we're concerned with.
But with respect to the leveraging, in the 2017 order, there was a statement about leveraging may play a part in the cross-product manipulation, but it's not a necessary condition. So where do you take that position now?
So I think, sorry, I didn't mean to talk about
that. Yeah, your position.
That goes to the structural point that this is an ex-ante rule, right? And so in my example, you know, you leveraging that you're planning to make a lot of money on this, you know, FTR by making these small bets in the virtual transactions or making specific bets that you're intent. Again, like it may play a part that you have, you know, used your virtual transactions to make money. We didn't think that when we're establishing an ex-ante rule that will just let you know when you engage in this conduct, you will forfeit. We didn't think it was necessary to consider that. We thought you could have a just and reasonable bright line.
What can a non-leveraged transaction be manipulative?
Again, I think the problem is that you don't, the way that the FTR is paying is different than the way that the individual virtual transaction is paying. And so you could be making a very large virtual transaction, expecting the price to be exactly the same today and tomorrow so that it'll net you nothing. But you want it to raise the value of your FTR. You know, if you want your FTR to go up by $100, you bet $1,000 over here, but your intent was to win on the FTR because you think that $1,000 here is not, you think there's going to be no congestion, no nothing. So you're betting that, assuming that tomorrow the price will be the same, right? You were intending to manipulate your FTR. You've made this bet with the intent to manipulate your FTR. But it turns out that in the virtual market, something happened that caused your bet to be a losing one. And so you made $100 on the FTR like you intended to. You actually, rather than paying selling for $1,000 today and buying for $1,000 tomorrow, something happened in that location such that the price you know, was different and you lost money. You intended to make money on your FTR by betting on your virtual transaction, but you didn't. And again, that's because the FTR can make money. The FTR can make money from the entirety of its path, like congestion on different points along its path. The virtual, in terms of the increment and decrement, is a specific location. And that's one of the actual narrowing provisions in the final rule, is that we didn't want to look at the entire FTR path. We wanted to look at where your virtual transaction caused, like, which constraint. There could be multiple congestion points on an FTR path. And if the one that led to their increase in value was not the one your virtual transaction had any impact on, you don't need to forfeit. Under the old rule, you actually would have forfeited.
Might have had a question.
Oh, sorry, Judge Rogers.
No, I thought the explanation was helpful.
I know I'm well over. If I could cite a couple.
I just want to note, I think that your opposing counsel made the point that if we can't understand what you did, then we should vacate because you haven't explained it adequately and haven't addressed it meaningfully. And through all this argument, I'm sort of starting to understand, but it seems that as an initial matter, like, you are obligated to address their concerns meaningfully. And if we're having so much trouble understanding what you did, why isn't this a remand so that you can explain it.
So I think part of that goes to, again, the structure of this proceeding, things like the intent point. Early on in the proceeding, in the 2017 order, we addressed a lot of these arguments. And in the 2021 order, we addressed some more. And, you know, by the time we got to the 2022 or the compliance order, right, we were directing them to make specific changes. And this is actually exactly what I was going to point to. In the 2021 order at paragraph 70, which is JA113, we rejected a leverage argument from another party. I'm not going to try to pronounce their name because it's long and complicated. Noting that, you know, we don't require PJM to exempt from forfeiture an effective FTR holder's positions where its virtual transaction position exposure is greater than its FTR exposure. We are not persuaded that these proposals are, at this time, necessary elements of a just and reasonable replacement rate. So we had earlier on said these are not necessary for a just and reasonable rate. The ultimate question we're trying to answer, and I think when you challenge our rate, you know, again, I understand, Judge Payne, you're making kind of an APA failure to explain challenge compared to an unjust and unreasonable rate challenge. But we had earlier on said, you know, we don't think that's necessary for an ex ante rule that is going to, you know, try to catch cross product manipulation. We just didn't think those were necessary provisions. We said it then. They came back and kept saying you can't be just and reasonable without these. And we again reiterated that. And as to kind of the explanation, my friend hit today that he hit in his reply brief and in his opening brief that in the rehearing order, we, you know, discussed portfolio leverage and portfolio FCR arguments together. If you look at the rehearing order, and I apologize, we didn't include the whole thing in the JA, but it's available, it's in the record. In their second and third statements of error, which we include in statements of error, it's their two merits arguments. If you look at the rehearing order, they switched between leverage and portfolio in the same paragraph after paragraph. I think it's pages, I want to say 10 to 13 of the rehearing order. But anyways, the point is they were addressing them both together in those challenges. We addressed them both in that paragraph, but there are earlier paragraphs addressing these various points.
But it seems that every time you address it, you say the same thing. We acknowledge that leverage may play a part in a cross-product manipulation, but it is not a necessary condition. And if that's not clear, it's not clear in every single order in which you said that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I don't have a number of, like, I gave the 2021 order citation, the next paragraph.
I'm looking at that.
We rejected right test now. For profitability. You know, I think I would have to go back and look at those and see what, you know, were we citing arguments the market monitor made, or et cetera. But, you know, our ultimate question in 2017 was, is this just and reasonable? And we were looking at a few factors. In 2021, we narrowed that saying, we think a just and reasonable rate needs to have certain provisions, but doesn't need to have these others. And so, you know, we didn't think catching Sienta, we didn't think catching kind of the profitability between the two markets were necessary to an ultimately just and reasonable.
I think it boils down to whether this sentence meaningfully addresses it, that it may play a part, but it is not a necessary condition.
And that's what I went to earlier.
Exactly. And if that's not clear, then you haven't meaningfully addressed it. Because you say the same.
Well, the question is where the commission has referred to its previous decisions. Isn't that the incorporation by reference that this has acknowledged?
Yes, but in the previous
decision, here it's too late to seek rehearing of the 2017 and 2021.
Yeah.
In any event, we can discuss that later.
If you indulge me, I have one other site in my notes that's just in the 2017 order at paragraph 80, which the note is JA38. We have rejected another party's, I think it was the, I don't know what the acronym stands for, but EDFT's argument for leverage and the footnote there. Anyway, so the 2017 order does have some discussion of this. I appreciate your question. And again, that sentence specifically, I think, is capturing the idea. If you don't think that we explained it early on, that's obvious. But the idea that a just and reasonable rate doesn't need this component, it's an ex ante sort of forward-looking point. If the court has no questions, I realize I'm very far over. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I please support?
Yes.
My name is Jeff Mays. I'm counsel for the independent market monitor for PJM. A core flaw in Xcel Energy's case is that it has appealed the wrong orders, the 2022 order and the 2022 rehearing order. The 2022 orders on appeal address a single component of the FDR forfeiture, the impact test. The impact test is the only issue within the scope of the 2022 order. Yet, Xcel does not appeal the impact test. Instead, the appeal addresses findings on other issues addressed in the 2021 order that is not on appeal and in the 2017 order. Xcel does not support its claim that an appeal of the 2022 order is proper. Xcel Energy cites cases that are not about FERC and RTO market rules. None of them are on point. The 2021 order is not abstract. It defines the scope of the compliance directive. Xcel Energy's arguments are all directed at the 2021 order. And FERC counsel earlier noted a decision in the unpublished in Louisiana Public Service Commission versus FERC, where this court found that the PSC's failure to appeal an earlier FERC order was not final. So at this time, I'd like to make myself available for questions, including.
But do you agree?
Sorry.
Go ahead, Judge Rogers.
Please, no, Judge Charles, please proceed.
Okay. Two questions. One is just your position on the remedy issue, and then also with respect to whether there's a violation of the filed rate.
We didn't take a position on the remedy issue. Our concern here really is to protect the FDR forfeiture rule. We think that is a very important rule for the efficiency of the markets and protecting against manipulation. We think such a rule always needs to be in effect as long as we have virtual trading in the markets. Having that rule is necessary in order to have virtual trading in the markets, and arguably even to have the two-stage day-ahead real-time market construct that we have.
Let me ask you, counsel, I read your brief. I didn't see that FERC adopted that position of forfeiture. Am I incorrect? Not that you don't state a forfeiture rule that this court has long recognized, that final rules cannot be collaterally attacked after the time for petitioning for review has expired. But did FERC pick up on that argument at any point? And I didn't hear it this morning either.
Yes, in the 2017 order, these issues, the issues in this case, were raised by Xcel Energy and perhaps were also raised by others. And a decision was made, a final decision, that those elements, those components are not necessary for a just and reasonable FDR forfeiture rule.
Right. But why would FERC not have picked up on this argument? I just wasn't clear about that because your brief was so definitive on this matter.
Right. I don't know why FERC didn't argue that as far as we did, but I would point to the 2017 order and the 2021 order. In the first compliance round, FERC basically states in its order that the arguments being raised by Xcel here, that they're not properly part of the compliance proceeding. And so I think that is, it's not in the current briefing stage, but in that 2021 order, I think FERC is saying essentially the same thing that we are arguing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I'd like to begin by taking a crack at the question that Judge Rogers just asked. I think the answer as to why the commission didn't adopt the IMM's argument is that this is not a collateral attack on a final rule. The rule was approved only in the order that is now on review. There were aspects of the rule that were passed, of other proposals, I should say, that were passed upon in earlier orders, but we had no obligation, and the commission did not say in its brief that we had any obligation to seek rehearing of those orders in order to preserve our arguments as to the final rule, which is now properly on review in this court.
So would you agree, though, that this court, given that FERC has referred to these actions it took previously in 2017 and 2021, that this court has traditionally looked for the explanation provided by the agency, and a reference is sufficient. In other words, when the agency has decided 1, 2, 3, it doesn't in the fourth situation also have to re-decide 1, 2, 3. It can simply refer to the orders on 1, 2, 3. And to the extent that the court is concerned about an adequate explanation, the court looks to the orders 1, 2, 3.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't take objection to with that principle at all.
Thank you.
The issue here is that if you look back, what you're essentially getting is 0 + 0 + 0 + 0 = 0.
No, I understand that that is your position, but that is not the agency's view of what it previously said. So your position in challenging the current order is that the court essentially is obligated to look at what authorities the agency cited, including its prior decisions that address issues you have raised in this appeal.
Yes, I completely agree with that, Your Honor. And
right,
on the portfolio issue, if you scour the record and look at all the orders, including the ones that are on review and the ones that were previously issued, you will find a rationale that's essentially market participants will have an incentive to manipulate a smaller FTR for the benefit of a smaller FTR, even if it's going to cause them to lose money on their overall portfolio. And as we explained in the brief, that doesn't make any sense. If you look back at all the orders, what you'll be left with on the leverage issue is a few orders that seem to conflate the leverage and the portfolio issue. And then I believe three orders that repeat the sentence about leverage being, you know, a factor, but not entirely determinative. And
isn't it correct, though, that you presented those two arguments basically together and not in these separate ways that you are explaining them and your meaning regarding these terms in response to Judge Pan's questions?
I wouldn't concede that, Your Honor. I think we presented them as independent arguments, and I think they're inherently independent arguments. They cover a different subject matter. As I acknowledged earlier, they're certainly related concepts, but they're independent arguments. And the commission—
Well, I understand that it's a different argument to say that something is blue and something is inequitable. But on the other hand, if you say not only is this order arbitrary and capricious for a number of reasons, it's also arbitrary because it's blue and the other factor. That's all I'm getting at. In other words, it's not as though you tried in this appeal to get the kind of decision from FERC to just repeat. You disagreed with it, but as FERC said on rehearing, here are the arguments you presented on rehearing, and that's what we're addressing.
I think if you look at FERC's brief in this court, their contention isn't these were all jumbled together, we didn't understand them, and so we gave a jumbled together response, and you should affirm because the arguments were presented in a way that was jumbled together. Their response is, on the portfolio issue, you would have an incentive to manipulate regardless of your portfolio. As we covered, that doesn't make any sense. On the virtual issue, they offer a rationale for their decision on the virtual, on the leverage issue, that again, what we hear today is an extreme elaboration on anything that we saw in the briefs or in the orders on review. The orders on review don't have a thorough explanation of their reasoning, don't provide any basis on which to conclude that their reasoning was either rational or irrational. They just state a conclusion, essentially, and that's not enough under Chenery. And to the question that Judge Pan asked earlier on, and Judge Schultz asked as well, on should the court remand or vacate and remand, our position is on the portfolio issue, there's really no way that on remand the agency is going to find the same way if they're forced to provide a rational explanation. And a sort of basic APA Chenery principle is that we don't just assume that the agency would reach the same result. If they provided reasoning that is irrational, there has to be some kind of showing before the court takes the step of remanding without vacater, which would leave in place a rule that has no justification for it, subject to the future actions of the agency. And I don't think it's a safe assumption in this case that if this were remanded to the agency, they would in fact come up with a rationale for the rule that they've adopted.
Well, so, that must be premised on your proposition that the agency was required to adopt your analysis. And the agency specifically on rehearing said it disagreed. And so to explain why it disagrees, we can look at what it said about this very issue. That's all I'm getting at.
Certainly under Chenery, you can look at what the agency said about the issue in the orders on review and the prior orders. But to the extent those don't provide a reliable indication that the agency will...
I understand that. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
If there's something further. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. The case is submitted.